The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN+.
Welcome to Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, creative advisor for the Second City. We are brought to you by Second City Works, which is the B2B arm of the world-famous Second City Theater. You can find us at secondcityworks.com. And this is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and your life. The term yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It's at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and making discoveries together. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Nicholas Epley. Nick is the John T. Keller Professor of Behavioral Science at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. His writing has appeared in the New York Times and dozens of journals. His book, Mindwise, was released to critical acclaim in 2014. The Financial Times named him a professor to watch. He is the winner of the Theoretical Innovation Prize from the Society for Personality and Social Psychology, and he was awarded the Distinguished Scientific Award for Early Career Contribution to Psychology from the American Psychology Association. Nick, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
All right. I want to start this conversation with a joke, but it's not my joke. It's your joke. So let it go. Let it go not unnoticed that it's a scholar who is initiating the joke on the Second City podcast. So here it is. A man on one side of a river shouts to a man standing on the other side, "Hey, how do I get to the other side of the river?" And the other man responds, "You are on the other side of the river." Mm-hmm. So that joke has special meaning. I think you always, and this is why you know it's a good joke, because I've been telling it lately, and people take a beat and then they laugh. You call it a lens problem, and maybe I want you to dig a little bit deeper into what the point of that particular joke is.
Yeah, so that joke reveals, I think, really a profound feature of social life, and that is we live in a world with lots of other people around, and yet we view the world from our own unique perspective in that world. That is, we tend to be egocentric, and so we see things from our own point of view, from our own vantage point, from our own reference point, and so that joke obviously makes that clear. How do you get to the other side of the river? The guy on the other side of the river says, "You are on the other side of the river." That's an egocentric bias, and that's a fact of how your brain works. You cannot have your brain in somebody else's head, and that egocentric bias we find in lots of research just colors lots of different judgments that we make about other people, judgments we make about ourselves, governs social interactions in powerful ways, and creates sometimes frequent misunderstandings between people.
Right, and so this reality can actually have somewhat devastating results. You actually wrote that, quote, "People's ability to spot deception was only a few percentage points better than a random coin flip."
Mm-hmm.
I don't think most people think that.
No, in fact, most people, so there are lots of things that make our judgments inaccurate. People don't seem to be aware of many of these things. And so the chronic problem with human judgment, we and many others find in their research, is overconfidence. So we're not aware, for instance, of the way in which our judgment is biased by our own egocentric perspective on that world. And that leads people then to believe that they see the world as it actually is. So if I think you are lying, I'm convinced that I'm right. If I think you're telling the truth, I'm convinced that I'm right, at least more right than I actually am. Overconfidence is a big problem. And so we find with lie detection, for instance, that people often predict they're 80% accurate in cases when, in fact, they're not meaningfully better than chance. Sometimes the gap can be quite huge.
Wow. All right. So you remember that television show Lie to Me?
Yeah.
So is that whole micro expressions thing not real?
Yeah. So that's very... It's a very contentious issue in psychology about the existence of a microexpression. So let me back up just a little bit in our conversation here. So psychologists for a while have known that it's difficult, very difficult, to read another person's mind. It's difficult to know what another person is actually thinking. And in fact, it's surprisingly difficult, such that people think they're more accurate than they actually are. So in lie detection, for instance, there's kind of a cottage industry on this in psychology. Psychologists who were studying this found in their work that when you ask somebody to tell a lie or a truth to a camera, people could rarely detect it better than chance levels whether you're actually lying or telling the truth. So in a massive meta-analysis of experiments some years ago, the general finding was that people were accurate across these experiments psychologists had conducted only about 54% of the time when chance was 50% telling lies. And so that led to led psychologists to look for other ways that lies and truths might actually leak out and actually be detectable without really knowing the fact of the matter. So the best way to know whether somebody's lying or telling the truth is to know what the facts are and to see that they're saying something different from that. Mm-hmm. And one of the suggestions of ways that we might be able to detect a lie from a truth is that emotions leak out when we're telling a lie that indicate fear, and that these are really subtle, that these are something that there's often just a flash of an emotion, micro expressions, they came to be called. These may show up just for a few milliseconds on a face, and although you might not be able to detect them with the naked eye, you can capture them with a video camera and notice it later. Now, the debate in psychology is about whether these actually exist or not. The original research found that you could detect these microexpressions, you could spot these microexpressions, but the trick in this work was that you already knew whether somebody was lying or telling the truth. The researchers tended to know this, and so they could go back and find an expression that was consistent with what they knew to be true. In other research, by Stephen Porter, for instance, a psychologist in British Columbia, he looked to see whether people actually, just in natural experience when they're lying or telling the truth, do they naturally show these micro expressions? Do they even reveal them? Not can you go back and find them, but do they actually show them? And so what he did was he had showed people images and had people either that these were highly emotionally evocative images, and either they were asked to reveal through their facial expressions what they were feeling, they were asked to mask it, that is to show nothing, or they were asked to mislead, to show the opposite. And so some people were lying, essentially, in their expression. Some people were showing the truth. And the question was, can you find in a situation like that evidence of microexpressions? This was the first time, this was just a handful of years ago, that any psychologist had actually checked whether people spontaneously show these. And this was already years after several seasons of Lie to Me had already been run.
Right.
And what Porter found was that no, in fact, people almost never show these microexpressions in this particular context. What's more, so out of about 700 different expressions that he had, he found only 14 instances where somebody showed a microexpression, and that was just on a partial expression on the face. And of those, half were cases where the person was revealing an honest emotion. The other half was when they were misleading. So it wasn't even that they indicated a true emotion. There's some evidence that maybe with really extreme cases, like in cases where people are lying about whether they kidnapped and killed their own children,
right?
So it's a pretty extreme lie, that maybe there's some evidence of micro expressions, but in general, they're not nearly as strong as certainly a show like Lie to Me would lead you to suggest. And psychologists have a hard time even spotting them themselves with cameras. They don't seem to exist.
Well, it's interesting too, because you can see why ideas like these, when circulated outside of the university, just sort of lay people like myself or my wife, whomever, pick them up, because you're like, oh, that seems intriguing. I want that to be true. And leads that. And I don't think I've told you this. And Nick and I know each other. When my wife Anne first read Paul Ekman's work on this, she like came to my office one day. I'm like, we should try to call him. And so literally, I tracked down the number, and I couldn't believe he took the phone call. And the only reason he did take the phone call, he was intrigued because Second City was calling him, because when he was studying at the University of Chicago in the 50s, He had a disastrous stint as a running the lights for the Compass Players, the precursor of Second City. He was at school with all those guys, Paul Sills and Mike Nichols, and actually got fired because he fell asleep during the show and didn't turn out the lights at the right time.
So he was hoping that you would somehow
absolve him, maybe
make that okay.
Decades later, absolve him of his. But
yeah, that's right.
But it was interesting.
Give him a job back.
Yeah. Well, and he was saying, like, I was like, well, if you were there at the same time and they were formating this improv stuff, and he's like, he goes, well, we didn't really talk about it. He goes, but it is not surprising to me in terms of where your work headed in terms of Second City and improvisation, the way that that's sort of, you know, grown out beyond even, you know, our walls. And then other advancements that were bubbling around at the same time. You know, when you look too at the guy who photographed all the early Second City shows was a gentleman named Morton Shapiro. His other job was photographing all the professors at the University of Chicago, many of whom were Nobel winners. So it was, you know, that sort of 40s, 50s time at the university seemed rather incredible.
Mm-hmm.
So, All right, I want to jump. Well, sticking to one last point of mine wise, because I want to move to some of your more recent research, but you do sort of offer up a way in which people can understand others, and it seems to sort of, you know, come down to be in a place where people feel free to speak truth, talk to them in person, and ask a lot of questions. Is that generally?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It turns out not to be magic. A person's mind comes through their mouth. There are lots of gimmicks about how to understand somebody better, but the best way to understand somebody is to become essentially a good journalist. To learn how to ask people questions, listen for their response, reiterate their response so you make sure that you got it right, and have them confirm it, and then continue.
Yeah,
that's it.
That's the good news, because that's something we can all do.
So you don't start asking people questions and listening for answers, though, often in daily life, because you think you know already. That's the problem.
Yeah.
Right. So if I think I know what your experience is, if I think I know what your beliefs are, I think I know what your perspective is, I think I know what your attitudes are, I think I know how you feel something about something, then I go on to whatever the next step is. I don't actually stop and check whether that's right. I don't actually stop and ask you questions directly. That's the problem with misunderstanding, is I think I know you much better than I actually do. So you don't get to that simple solution unless you recognize that, in fact, you're mistaken to begin with, or more likely to be mistaken understanding somebody else than you actually think.
Right. All right. And a lot of your research sort of swims in these waters. And I was reading a paper that you wrote on bounded self-righteousness and social judgment. And I'll quote you here. You say, compared with people in general, most people see themselves as more ethical, more competent at their job, friendlier, and more intelligent. And as I was reading that, I'm like, there's a pretty big however that's about to come.
Mm-hmm.
What is the however with regard to that? People see themselves as this, but in fact?
But in fact, the effect is much bigger on one side than another. That is, self-righteousness, the tendency to think you're more moral than other people, we find, is really about thinking that you're not as bad than other people, not that you think you're more ethical than other people. Mm-hmm. So often self-righteousness are cases where people report feeling holier than thou, or people believe that they're holier than thou, that is, they're more ethical than other people. That's not actually what we find in this research. We find that self-righteousness instead, or people's general beliefs about their moral character compared to others, is that they're not as evil as other people. They're not as unethical as other people. So it's not that, Kelly, you think you're more likely to donate charity to somebody else, or don't donate to charity than other people, or stop on the street and help somebody fix a flat tire. But it's that you are less likely than others to be stingy and not donate. You're less likely than others to just drive on by and refuse to help somebody. So there's an asymmetry here in self-righteousness, we find.
Well, and that explains my social media feed. which is almost all outrage at political scandal or corporate malfeasance. But anytime there's like this, like a great ethical story, and I'm thinking we got a call from Chobani yogurt the other day, and I had to do a little research. And I'm like, man, the guy who founded that, the CEO, yeah. gave shares of his company stock to all his employees, and that yeah. story is showing up nowhere. Yet the slightest yep. you know problem that exists in some business, and everyone's piling on.
Yep, absolutely. And of course, the general sentiment is that I never would have acted that way had I been in that situation. Hmm. That's what creates some of the outrage, right? That I wouldn't have done that. I wouldn't have cheated like that. I wouldn't have lied like that. I wouldn't have stolen like that. I wouldn't have done that bad thing that you or somebody else did. That's what creates the outrage.
That's interesting, because that's the easy way out. I mean, I think it's, you know, as opposed to the much harder thing. This is interesting, too, jumping to another paper that you wrote called The Sound of Intellect with Juliana Schroeder. And this is fascinating, because you say research has revealed the unique importance of one's voice over and above the semantic content of the person's language. And even adding visual information doesn't make those interactions more meaningful. Like, how did you even test this? How did you test that the human voice has that kind of power?
Yeah, well, let me explain, back up a little bit to this particular research question that we started with. So most of the work that we do in my lab is about mind reading, how we make inferences about each other's thoughts and beliefs and attitudes. And mostly I'm interested in how we screw that up and misunderstand each other in certain ways. Another person's mind is the most complicated thing you're ever going to spend any time thinking about. And so it's not surprising that we're less than perfect. We try to understand why we're sometimes less than perfect. This is interesting from a psychological perspective, of course, not just in everyday life, but from a psychologist's perspective, because I never actually have direct access to your mind. This has been commented on by great thinkers going all the way back to the ancient Greeks and solipsism, who the solipsist pointed out that the only thing you'd be certain of is your own mind. Mm-hmm. I can't be certain, in fact, that you think or feel or have beliefs, and yet we make those kinds of inferences very easily all the time. But given that I can't see you thinking, I can't feel you feeling, I can't see what your motivations or desires directly are, you can only feel those directly, how do I come to know them? So how do I get access to your thoughts or your beliefs or attitudes? How do I get access to your inner mind? Well, if you think about it for a little bit, how is it that you communicate what's on your mind to somebody else? Yeah. Well, language is the tool mm-hmm. that we use to do that, right? So language is what communicates our knowledge and our beliefs and our attitudes. What we're doing right now, for instance, is entirely language-based. That's how you communicate complicated knowledge from one mind to another. That's how I reveal my mind to you. But of course, language can be communicated to somebody else in multiple different ways, right? Right. Multiple different mediums. The medium that I interact with you can affect how the kind of information that's conveyed. So I can type something to you, right, with language. I can speak the same text to you with my voice. I can see you while I'm hearing you do this thing. If your mind is conveyed most clearly through language and through your voice, then there may be additional cues in the voice that is closely connected to ongoing mental experience as you're having it. So I can't see your mind. I can't see you thinking. I can't see you reasoning. I can't see you engaging in analytical thought. But we thought that you might be able to hear it. Hmm. In particular, your voice has all kinds of paralinguistic cues in it that communicate information above and beyond the simple words, beyond above the semantic content. So your voice goes up and down, right, in pitch. That's intonation. It gets louder and it gets softer. It speeds up and it slows down. And we reason that all of those cues, all of that, those paralinguistic cues are essentially variants that so that your voice sort of moves. And we predicted that those paralinguistic cues then, a little like bodily motion communicates bodily life. I know you're alive because you move. We thought that movement in your voice, speeding up and slowing down, variance in pitch, might communicate the fact that you have a lively mind as well, that you're alive on the inside. Mm-hmm. So I can hear you thinking, I can hear you reasoning when your voice goes up and down, when it speeds up and it slows down. That's what led us to our hypothesis that people might seem more mindful, more thoughtful, more intelligent, more reasonable, more rational when you hear what the person has to say than when you read exactly the same text. And so we've now done a bunch of experiments that test that particular hypothesis. So in one experiment, for instance, the one from the paper you're describing here, we had our MBA students give an elevator pitch. Now, you know what an elevator pitch. Anybody who's ever interviewed for a job knows what an elevator pitch. It's the two-minute spiel that I give to some potential employer that should explain to them why that person should hire me for this job. And we had our MBA students either type this out or we had them speak it with their voice. That allowed us to videotape the spoken elevator pitch and create three conditions out of that. One, spoken pitch. You could see the audio tape. You could, so audio visual, so you could see the person and hear them. Just the audio, you could just hear the person. Or we could transcribe the audio into a transcript. And so you could read exactly the same semantic content. And then we could also use the written pitch that they wrote independently, which was meant to be read. We then had people evaluate this MBA student and say how mindful they were, how thoughtful, how intelligent, how rational does this person seem to be. They reported their impression of this person. How positive is your impression? How negative is this your impression? And we also had them report how interested you would be in hiring this person if you were considering hiring, if you were interviewing this person for a job. One of the studies used professional recruiters from Fortune 500 firms. These are people who do this for a living. They showed exactly the same effects that I'm about to describe to you. And what we found here was that people seemed more mindful, more thoughtful, intelligent, rational, more interested in hiring the person when the observers heard what the person had to say, when they heard their pitch, than when they read exactly the same content in a transcript or when they read it in a written pitch. Being able to see the person didn't affect evaluations of the person's mind above and beyond just being able to hear the person. And that we find pretty systematically across experiments, that being able to see somebody didn't systematically affect my judgment of your mental capacity. After all, I can't see you thinking. Right? I mean, you can, but it's weak. It's a weak cue compared to the strong cue that you get in somebody's voice. So you can tell, for instance, that I'm enthusiastic and interested and excited about my work when you hear me speak.
Yeah.
That's a big cue.
Yeah.
We find in our work.
It's funny, when I had to do a TEDx, a couple of them, and so I was researching tips. And Chris Anderson himself, who runs that company, was sort of pointing to the most successful TED Talks don't use a lot of visual imagery. That the Ken Robinsons of the world know what they're talking about and communicate it to them through stories and ideas, but their own experience and this idea of sort of authenticity of communication, which was very, very attractive to me because I'm terrible at putting together those decks. So the fact my sort of, you know, inexperience with technology was a welcome thing with regard to this level of communication, because I do think a lot of people feel like I need a PowerPoint to get this thing across.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, if you're showing results from a regression table, you need a PowerPoint slide. Otherwise, maybe not.
Yeah. All right, and so, you know, when you think about all the stuff that we're talking about, and a lot of it is our misconceptions, right? Which are two things to me. One, they're naturally funny. When you think about the root of almost all comedy is almost two things. It's an expectation that's been subverted. That's jokes, but that's also almost any sort of comedic setup. Is you think it's going to go one way and it goes in another way, and usually that other way reveals some level of truth that you maybe hadn't been thinking about. So you have this sort of surprise moment, and then an improvisation itself. It starts with the premise that when you get groups of people together, they're likely to do things wrong. So we're going to give you these cues, like say yes yes and instead of no, and be others yeah. focused and practice listening. So we just announced yesterday a big new partnership between Second City and the University of Chicago, the Center for Decision Research. And Nick is crucial to this. He's one of our top guys there. We're going to look at behavioral science through the lens of improvisation. And I'm curious, because you and I have not spoken about this, and I don't know how you, because you know, my very first conversation with our mutual friend Heather Caruso, when someone went into your office and said, "Hey, I just talked to Second City, and they might want to do something together." I'm curious what your first reaction was.
I thought this was going to be funny, but I don't know how it's going to work.
Yeah, well, yeah. I think that's still accurate.
Yeah, my initial reaction was, "Wait a minute, what do these folks know about science?"
Uh huh.
Is what do they know about experiments? So I've been working for years trying to connect us here at the University of Chicago to companies that we would be able to do experiments with. And all along, I've been looking for companies that have some background in experiments, experimentation, and in measurement of phenomena that they might care about, thinking that what we need to do is to find companies that sort of have scientists on the inside.
Right.
And connect with them, or with people who have good measurement of things that we can then go in and work with. And that has not, that was always my mindset. It's not proven very successful over the years. I can explain why in a second. But my initial thought was that Second City is not the standard thing that we go after. But after about 2 minutes of talking with Heather about it, it was clear that I think we've been thinking about this wrong in the way we've approached this over the years. And in fact, the approach that you take in improv is much more aligned with what we do as scientists than I ever would have guessed, and is actually the more critical connection, I think, which is why I'm really excited about this collaboration.
Yeah.
And the critical overlap is So in improv circles, you're not measuring things so precisely. You're not doing the outcome thing so precisely. But what you're doing all the time is experimental manipulation.
Yep.
The essence of any experiment is we have to have people in one condition doing one thing and people in another condition doing something else. You have to be doing things differently. Or with different people. And that's what improv is all about.
Yep.
So you have the core of the scientific methodology in any kind of improv session. Let's try it this way. Let's try it that way. In an experiment, all we do is we just randomly assign people to do it one way and then another, or one way or another. And so improv inherently has scientific methodology built into it, and I think we'll be able to harness that very easily. I think we'll be able to plug that into a scientific paradigm without any trouble at all. We just then give people surveys when they're done with it.
Right, right.
Which would be pretty easy to do.
Yeah, I mean, and I think from our point of view too, has always been like we have these, you know, we have these anecdotal understandings of our work, and that's fine. And we work with so many corporate clients who are like, well, what's the ROI, you know, and what's the data say? And we're always like, well, I don't have any data. And I think our thinking was always like, well, you can't. How are you going to get data out of this? Not really recognizing that, like you say, no, there's already controlled studies, and there's other studies, and we're not afraid of repetition. Like, no, we need to do this 150 times. And by doing it 150 times, you figure out what works. And what we sometimes, I think, mistakenly thought was sort of the magic of theater was, in fact, maybe a bit of science that we didn't know we were doing. And I know this from when I would produce shows with some of our best directors who would see a scene over and over not work, and then them realize, oh, he just has to cheat his face out when he delivers that line, give that note to the actor, they do it, it works, everyone in the audience responds, you're like, okay, great, that's it. But that was through this sort of repetition and observation and understanding the conditions actually that you're working in too, which is also a fascinating thing about Second City, which is, you know, we'll have the very same scene that we do in Chicago on Well Street that will not work at all in Austin, Texas, in an auditorium. And for me, as we're looking, and there's so much to study and so much to look at inside this work, you know, empathy and listening and truth and ethics and all that. There's also that sort of look of comedy of like, ah, we have an instinct why this doesn't work. Can you tell us now why it doesn't work?
Yeah. Yeah. So we can. So we were always thinking that what we want are folks who can do measurement out in the world, and then we would go into these companies, and they would never be willing to run an experiment with us because they couldn't manipulate something. Mm-hmm. They couldn't have half of their employees do one thing and the other half do something else. They couldn't have, you know, half of the days they do something, and on the other half we have them go off and do another thing. They could never do the experimentation part.
Mm-hmm.
The measurement they had down, but the actual science they couldn't do. But I'm excited about this. We can add the measurement. That's pretty easy for us to do. It's the experimentation that's hard, and improv just has that built in top to bottom.
Yeah, yeah. I'm pretty excited. And you know, it's interesting. I've said this to some other folks when we've talked about it, which is, you know, I don't think even 5 years ago that this conversation necessarily would have gone anywhere. And I was there was a professor friend of mine who I was sitting with at an event, and he said, yeah, well, also, you know, no one was teaching cinema arts, 25 years ago. You know, you need time for these. Mm. This is an art form that started in the, you know, mid-50s. So it's reached a certain maturity and a certain level of popularity now, right? Because you can't throw a ball without hitting an improv troupe somewhere. And I do apologize to the rest of America for that, because there's a lot of bad improv going on. But I think the greater reason that so many people do it is it does feel good. And I think, in fact, one of the ways it feels good is because it is so others focused. A huge requirement of improvisers and certainly a hallmark of experienced improvisers is their ability to adopt the viewpoint of the person across from them. It is almost like a perspective booster shot, we think.
Uh-huh.
And so much of your work is about the fact that we underestimate the value of, like, living in another person's shoes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? You have a great quote from To Kill a Mockingbird when Atticus Finch says to Scout, "You never really understand a person until you consider things from his point of view." And I guess that tends to be true across the board, right, from your studies?
Well, what we find is that you really understand a person when you're in their point of view, when you're really in their shoes. That's what really increases understanding. Putting yourself in their shoes, though, thinking about things from other people's perspective, tends to do really powerful things for people's happiness and for their well-being. So if psychologists want to make people feel miserable in the lab, for instance, we've known this since the 70s, you bring people in and have them focus on themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You want them to feel happy, bring them in and have them focus on somebody else. If you want to feel happy at the end of the day, do something before the day is out that'll make you feel happy. Write a gratitude letter to somebody else. Think about somebody who's done something good for you and write something expressing your appreciation. That is, focus on somebody else, not on yourself. That makes people feel amazingly good.
And that's great news. I mean, what?
That is good news, yes.
Right? I mean, what
it turns out that ethics, being nice to other people and being happy, are nicely aligned.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
It didn't have to work out that way in the world, but it does work out that way.
All right. So there's a good note to sort of ask my final question, which is, we always end these podcasts with asking our guests if they have a yes and story. So, you know, in improvisation, if you say no, that's going to get the scene nowhere. And you can't just stop at yes. You have to say yes and. You have to explore and heighten what's in front of you. And I'm wondering if you have a yes and story, either from your work or your life, that you could share with us.
Yeah, so the most powerful, life-changing yes-and moment in my life was when we adopted two children from Ethiopia. So this happened 6 years ago. My wife had wanted to have more children. We already had two biological children, and for a long time I was in the no camp there. that I thought I had plenty of kids. I didn't think that I was going to be a good father to more than two. I've got a very active job. Mm-hmm. Life was pretty intense. I didn't think that I could take on more and still be a good father. But eventually, I mean, you can only say no to your wife for so long on that. And eventually I said yes. And we decided that we would do something different. The earthquake in Haiti had just hit, and so adopting was on our mind. It had been for a while. And so we adopted two beautiful children from Ethiopia, and it's life-changing in all the ways that having children is, and it's brought a diversity of perspective to our lives that we never would have had before. It's connected us with the other side of the planet in a way that'll change the rest of our lives. It's been an amazing experience.
That's great. That's the best Yes And story. Nick Epley, thank you for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks, Kelly. Appreciate it. Well, I've been working here.